lucky. Corinne was not that lucky. We never knew this. Hannah Pardo was the one who broke Corinne's father open, let him weep out all his secrets. Hannah Pardo knew how to push and where. Probably because of what my father had told her. "It's a family matter," he'd said, lowering his voice, giving it meaning. Corinne had two much younger siblings. She was 11 when her parents had Paul Jr., PJ, Corinne called him, and Layla followed 2 years after. They were little kids, 7 and 5, when Corinne went missing. Silent and stoic, unusual for children. That's what Hannah Pardo told Brix, and what Brix told everyone else. Hannah asked them questions as they sat on the white sectional sofa in their living room, and their mother handed out lemonade, and they looked at their father, waiting for their orders. They looked at their father when Hannah asked if Corinne had seemed sad or upset, or if they'd heard her say anything. "Any little thing at all," she'd said. "Anything about her state of mind." They looked at their father, questioning. They looked at him like the answer. Corinne's mother had taken her to the hospital twice. Hannah Pardo read the reports out loud to Corinne's father, once for a dislocated elbow, climbing out the window, Corinne had told us, rolling her eyes, another for a laceration at the hairline, river jumping, damn slippery rocks.
"Yes," her dad said to Hannah Pardo. "Because of me."
Sobbing big, ugly tears. Hannah Pardo called Brix and Fraze in because she was so sure he was going to confess to everything. He wasn't the kind of drunk to sit at the bar, like my father, getting lost in himself. He was the kind who drank whiskey in the living room, finding people to be pissed at instead of himself.
"I didn't hit her," he claimed. "I never hit her."
"No," her mother said, "he never did. Just punished her. Pushed her if she tried to talk back. Once he pushed her down the stairs. Just the once. That was the elbow." His grip was tight and unyielding. He threw dishes at walls near their heads. One time he missed. He was full of threat and menace, and at some point Corinne grew immune. Immune to the sound of a bird flying into a window, its wings beating relentlessly upon the ground. She'd leave her house, coming over to mine, telling me we had plans. I can see it now, the meaning under her words. "What, did you have a mind fuck or something? We have plans. I was supposed to sleep over." Eventually, I stopped going along with it. I pushed her away, too. They searched her house for blood, for evidence, for signs that there was another accident that her father covered up. I couldn't imagine. Corinne giving the fake stories at the hospital. I fell. I was sneaking out the window and I fell. Letting her father win. I couldn't picture that Corinne. The one who cowered, keeping her eyes on the floor. Her power, I realized, was not limitless, as we had all believed. It had borders, and when she left that house, she refused to give another inch. It was a learned trait, how to push, how to manipulate. She knew the line to walk. She learned that from her father. Push, but not too hard. Crack, but do not break. The darkness lives in everyone. She knew this better than anyone. Everyone had two faces, and she looked deep into us each until she found it. I see a Corinne every year, can pick her out from the other side of my desk, the strong-willed, the cruel, the worshipped. The sad, sad girl sketched in pencil that you only see when you remove the people surrounding her. Don't remove them. Please. Don't. She's mean, but she loves you, I want to tell them. Wait it out. Look closer. I see the long sleeves, and I know what's underneath. The uneaten lunch tray, ignored as she cuts someone down. The boy she pushes away over and over, hoping they'll come back, because they can't get too close. She can't let them. I want to call her into my office for no reason at all. Ignore the one struggling with too much school pressure or parents getting divorced. Or the one literally starving for attention. I want this girl, who doesn't show up in my files. I want to call her in just so she knows, as they grow up, and as everyone abandons her, as they inevitably will, that I am here. This time, I am here. Tyler called, jarring me awake just as I drifted to sleep. His name on the display, and there he was, an image in my mind, safe and nearby. Hello? Tyler? I pushed myself out of bed, walked down the hall in case he was in his truck out front, underneath the steady drizzle.
Hey, Nick.
You're okay? You're home? The night was dark, and I didn't see any sign of Tyler.
Yeah. Jackson said you were worried.
He was worried. I mean, I was too. Where were you?
Taking care of some stuff.
Why'd you leave your phone? A pause like I should know better.
Forgot it.
I hated that Tyler was lying to me. We weren't supposed to lie to each other. We might not say all of what we were thinking, but we never lied. I'd made him promise that. Tyler, I said, talk to me. Please. I thought you were hurt. I thought... I shifted uncomfortably in the silence that followed.
I went to Mississippi,
he said, his voice quick and hushed, without his phone, the unspoken understanding. To her father's place?
I just wanted to check for myself. No sign of Annalise,
he said.
No sign of anything.
I stayed on the phone, listening to him breathe. Eventually, he broke the silence.
You were right,
he said.
We need some space.
I felt him drifting even further as we spoke. Tyler.
Do you need anything, Nick?
Like a professional courtesy. What did I really need? From him? For him? Just to know you're okay.
I'm okay,
he said.
See you around, Nick.
There was something both familiar and discomforting about the rain here. In the city, it hit the windows and streets and flooded the gutters, like it was encroaching on us. It caused traffic jams and made apartment lobbies too slippery. But here, the rain was just another part of the landscape, like it was the thing that lived here and we were merely visitors. It made me feel small and temporary, made me imagine my mother in this very house, hearing this very rain, the same water molecules, recycled and replaying, like the circular diagram in science class. And before that, my grandparents buying this land, building this house from the ground up, standing in front of this window, listening to the same thing. Some religions believe time is cyclical, my father had said, that there are repeating ages, but to others, time is God, a gift for us to stretch out and exist in. It was a comfort to me, the sound of my father's voice, trying to make sense of things. Because the thing about standing here in the middle of the mountains with the rain coming down in a house your grandfather built is that it's too easy to notice how insignificant you are. How quickly you might go from something to nothing. How one moment you can be a girl laughing in a field of sunflowers and the next, a haunting face on a poster in a storefront window. How terrifying, empty and hollow, and then, how absolving. I brought Tyler outside in the rain once, asked him, "Do you feel it?" Laced my fingers with his and waited for his whispered, "Yes." He could have been talking about anything, the cold on his face, the rainwater in his shoes, the sky whispering to him about love and loneliness and me. But I liked to believe he felt the same, that he was the person who always understood. I tried to get back to sleep. I lay in bed and closed my eyes, concentrating on the sound of the rain on the roof, hoping it might keep my mind empty, lull me into gentle oblivion. But Cooley Ridge was talking to me with each drop, nudging me awake. Keep your eyes open. Look. Time can weave around and show you things if you let it. Maybe this was how. Maybe Cooley Ridge was trying to show me. Time was trying to explain things. Tick, tock. The day before. Day 7. The house looked brighter, more alive with the fresh coat of paint that Laura had picked out. Pale almond, she'd called it. But the furniture had been pulled away from the walls and sat at unnatural angles, haphazardly covered with sheets of plastic, giving the whole downstairs a funhouse feel. I must have grown immune to the smell of paint sometime during the night. It wasn't until I stepped out to toss the plastic in the trash and went back inside that it hit me. The wall of fumes, sticky and suffocating, that no open windows could alleviate. We needed to run the air, to circulate everything through the filters. We needed the damn air conditioning. I positioned Daniel's box fans throughout the downstairs, turned them on, and left the windows open. And then I left. An accidental, catastrophic electrical fire would not be the worst thing that could happen to this house. There's a Sunday brunch at Grand Pines that makes it family day. Go to church, then visit the family you've sent away. A day of penance. Eat your weight in sins. Guilt by omelet. It was a buffet, and I was following Dad down the line, my tray sliding along the metal grooves behind his, sounding like nails on a chalkboard.
"Try the bacon,"
he said, and I obligingly placed a strip on my plate.
"Skip the eggs,"
he said from the side of his mouth.
"Biscuits, take two."
I took one. I had no appetite and didn't want to waste them if they weren't really that good. In the bag slung over my shoulder, I carried a paper signed by a doctor that I'd picked up at the front desk. An affidavit attesting to my father's mental incompetency and his need for a guardian. We needed one more before filing with the court, and the on-site doctor had already gotten me a referral for someone who would visit later this week. I felt like I was lying to Dad, placing bacon on my plate, taking his advice, acting like I was here for the food, for his company. I wasn't not here for those things, but they weren't the primary reason. I wondered if Daniel and Laura made it a habit to meet him here for brunch. Probably. Dad had smiled when I came in, like it was the most natural thing in the world for me to be here, and part of me wondered if the affidavit was wrong, if maybe he was getting better, if this was all reversible, a horrible, temporary thing that would gradually unwind itself. "Gosh, Dad, remember that time you couldn't remember us? Really gave me a scare." We sat at the table where I'd met him at last week, apparently his regular spot. "You should see Laura," I said to him. "I went to her shower yesterday. She looks like she's about to pop." He laughed.
"What are they having?"
He knew this. He should have known. "A girl." A slight nod from him. "Shayna," I said, and his eyes locked on mine, then slowly drifted to the side. It was the wrong thing to say. I'd lose him to her now. Watch them both disappear.
"You know, when your mother brought me home the first time, I fell in love."
Or this time he would take me there with him. "With Cooley Ridge?" I asked.
"Well, you don't have to make that face, Nick."
He grinned.
"But no, not Cooley Ridge. I fell in love with her. Because I could see all of her there. She was like a puzzle piece out of context. But when I put her there, where she was from, it was like I understood. She was so beautiful."
My clearest memories of my mother were the ones where she was fading, sick, in a wheelchair with a yellow and blue quilt across her legs because she was always cold, Daniel holding a cup with a straw in front of her, both of them getting skinnier, paler, sharper. In pictures, she was beautiful. Before the cancer, she was this perfect mix of sharp and soft, with a genuinely warm smile.
"You really do look like her. You and Daniel both. Spitting images of her,"
he said. "Daniel looks like you." I tried the bacon, but in rolled the nausea. I broke it into smaller pieces so he wouldn't notice.
"Now sure, that's what people say. But when you guys were kids, it was all Shayna."
He looked me over.
"Imagine if she hadn't had kids. All of her would be lost now."
"Okay," I said. I didn't like the way he was looking at me, like there was something of her still living, a puzzle piece out of context, a part of her stuck over my left eye, to my bottom lip, the ridge of my spine, concentrating on me like Corinne once had until she pretended she could find the monster in us.
We almost didn't, you know. When her parents died in that accident and she found herself all alone in the world, she told me she would never have just one child. It was none at all or more than one. There was no debating.
He chewed his food, rolled his eyes.
So stubborn. For a long time I thought it would be none. I really did. Daniel caught us by surprise, you know.
No, I didn't know. My parents were older when they had us, but I assumed that was deliberate. Careers first, then family.
That's when we moved back. She was desperate to have you as soon as possible. God, she drove me crazy. I really didn't get why it was such a big deal, but she was determined that what happened to her would never be her child's fate. Alone with no family. She was adamant that you'd have each other always. Now that she's gone, I can see she was right, of course. Daniel needed you.
I'm sure he wouldn't agree with that, I laughed. I'm a pain in his ass.
No. No, Nick. You're exactly what he needs. He knows it. You know how he is, though.
There were no safe topics anymore. Doctors sending affidavits to declare my dad incompetent. Missing girls. A house full of secrets. Accidental children. Daniel. And there were eyes everywhere. Not just in the woods. In this place, too. I felt my eyes roaming, my fingers drumming on the table. I could only tap into subjects with Dad, circling them from far away, grazing off the top, not getting him worked up, not pushing things to the surface that needed to remain below. But I needed him to know some things. I needed him to understand. Tyler's been doing some work on the house for us, I said, picking at the biscuit.
That's good. He's a good man.
You never liked him when we were kids, I teased.
That's not true. He worked hard and he loved you. What's not to like?
I thought fathers of teenagers were supposed to hate their daughters' boyfriends. It's a rule.
I never read the handbook, obviously,
he said. Then he pushed himself back in the chair.
I never knew what to do with you, Nick. About you, I mean. You turned out good, though, all on your own.
I didn't turn out good, I said, half laughing, crumbling the biscuit so it fell into uneaten sections.
You did, though. Look at you. Look at you now.
I needed to steer the conversation gently back, carefully. Tyler said the house would be worth more if we finished the garage, I said. Remember when you and Daniel were going to do it? He looked into my eyes, smiling.
He asked me,
he said, thinking about the wrong thing, the very wrong thing.
Or he told me. You know Tyler. Said he wanted to marry you.
I felt warmth flooding my face, my fingertips tingling, trying to imagine that conversation. I hadn't known that, and the surprise caught me by the neck. He did, huh? What did you say?
I said you were just kids, of course. I told him to see the world first. I told him about time.
His eyes drifted to the side, and I could sense his mind starting to drift as well. What about time? I asked, pulling him back. He refocused on me.
That it shows you things if you let it.
I tilted my head to the side. That's what Mom used to say. When she was sick and I was crying and she said she could see me and Daniel both, the beautiful people we would become.
Well, that's what I told her. When she was pregnant with Daniel, she worried so much, and the same with you, so we used to make up these stories.
Dad was getting sucked into the memories. I'd lose him if I didn't ground him in the now. What did Tyler say to that? I asked. Maybe I just really wanted to know. To see the conversation, a fly on the wall. Tyler sitting on the couch, my dad in his chair.
Hmm?
He looked up and shrugged.
He didn't say anything. He wasn't asking for my permission, so I told him, "Don't be mad when she says no."
I smiled.
I thought you should know that. It was the day the Prescott girl... Well, there were more important things after that, and then you left. But I wanted you to know about that. He's good. He's a good guy. I think he's still mad at me, though, for not giving him your new number.
You're a good dad, I said. You really are.
I'm a shitty dad, and I know it. But I tried to do the right thing when it counted. I'm not sure how that went.
Dad, look at me. It's done, I said. I stared at his eyes, willing him to remember this conversation. Whatever happened back then, it's over. It's done. It's time to put the house up for sale. He sliced into his biscuit, pointed the butter knife at my heart.
Eat your breakfast, sweetheart. You're starting to disappear.
I knew that the answers to Annalise's disappearance hinged on what she saw 10 years ago, even if the police weren't quite there yet. I knew the answers were going to come all at once. That people wouldn't find out what had happened to Annalise without finding out what had happened to Corinne, and neither would I. I had to go back in time. I had to, while the investigation was still in the find-her stage, before it morphed into something more, something worse. Hannah Pardoe showed up from out of town 10 years ago with her stoic expression and bright red lipstick, on a mission. The investigation morphed from find the girl to solve the case. Those were two very different things, two very different assumptions. 1 week after Annalise's disappearance, and I could feel the shift starting. I had to understand how everything looked from Annalise's point of view, all of it. Starting at the beginning of that night 10 years ago. Starting with what she saw at the fair. The fair doesn't really have an official entrance. It has a field that turns into a parking lot that funnels between the buildings that were stables, now used to sell ticket stubs for rides and games. There's a storage shed of first aid equipment off to the side of the stables slash ticket booths, and past that, nothing but trees. Through the old stables, the space opens up to fields where once a year, for 2 weeks, the booths come to life, and the Ferris wheel looms, proud and majestic. In the fall, hot air balloons rise up, tethered to the earth. It was the place we went to touch the sky. The air tonight was full of noise. Kids cheering or whining, parents laughing and shouting, music from the rides, bells from the game booths. Teenagers calling to each other across the grounds, from a picnic table, from the front of the portable restrooms, from the top of the Ferris wheel. My breath caught, seeing it circle from the parking lot. Unlike most things that appeared smaller now that I'd grown, the Ferris wheel looked bigger, more untouchable. I tried to picture a girl hanging from outside of the cart. I'd be panicked. I'd be sick. I'd be furious. A girl in a skirt on the outside of the cart, her best friend whispering in her ear, her boyfriend watching from below. Maybe we did bring it on ourselves. This, right here, was the closest I'd felt to Corinne in a long time. I could feel her cold hands at my elbows, hear her breath at my ear, smell the spearmint gum on her whisper. If I could just close my eyes and reach across time and hold her wrist, wrap my arms around her for no reason at all. I wouldn't dare. I never dared. Someone slammed into my side, a little kid, maybe 3 years old, colliding with me before changing trajectory, running into someone else on his rush inside. His parents gave me a hurried, sorry, and chased after him. The sun was low, almost gone, and the field lights turned on as I stood there watching. The grounds were garish and exposed, my eyelids slamming closed in response. I walked between the ticket booths. The grass had always been worn away here. It was mostly dirt with small patches of green. Right near the entrance, right here in this dirt, this was where I fell to my side. This was where Daniel hit me in full view of the Ferris wheel. I spun around, pictured Annalise leaning against the side of this building, eating her strawberry ice cream. Watching us all. Me running for Tyler, Tyler waiting for me, and Daniel grabbing me by the arm, hitting me across the face. Tyler lunging, punching Daniel in the face, then crouching beside me, his hands pulling my twisted arm away from my body.
You okay? Nick, are you okay?
I don't know. I don't. Frantically scrambling in the dirt, standing, leaning on Tyler, feeling everything realign, the burn of the hit, the sting of the moment. I'm okay, I said, His hands were everywhere, pushing my hair aside, over my face, down my neck, my arms, my waist. He glanced over my shoulder, his jaw set, and I saw Corinne jogging toward us. Bailey was in the distance, weaving through the crowd. I didn't know if Annalise was still there. I hadn't looked again. Maybe she was just outside the entrance. Maybe she'd run behind the building, watching through the stable slats that I could see now with her doe-like eyes. Yes, she had confirmed our alibi, but I was wondering if she had also witnessed what came next. Tyler had pulled me up, checked me again, asking over and over if I was okay.
"Wait here,"
he'd said. He stood over my brother, put a hand down and leaned toward him, said something in his ear. Daniel looked straight at me, straight into me, so I had to look away.
"Nick,"
he pleaded from across the way, but by then Corinne was already there. "Bailey, go find some ice," Corinne had called as she approached, and I could feel her presence taking over, taking control. I'd walked away. I'd left, taking Tyler with me, and we found the first aid shed where a man sat in a folding chair, a lump of tobacco in the side of his mouth.
"You kids okay?"
he asked, not standing.
"Do you have ice?"
Tyler asked. The man opened a blue cooler at his feet, used a plastic cup to scoop some ice into a Ziploc bag for me. Tyler checked me over again, asked me if I was okay again, his hands running everywhere. "Tyler," I said, "your hand." Two knuckles were scraped as if they'd hit the wrong angle on one of Daniel's sharp edges, and his fingers were discolored. I asked the attendant for band-aids. He eyed Tyler's hand.
"Might be broke,"
he said.
"It's fine,"
Tyler said, pulling me away.
"Come on."
But I could see the man was right. It was swelling and red, and Tyler kept it hanging limply by his side. "Tyler..."
"I'll take a bag of ice, too,"
he mumbled. "At least go wash it off," I said. He nodded.
"Okay. You won't move?"
"I'll be right here," I said. But the second he was out of sight, all I could picture was Daniel sitting in the dirt, his bloody nose, and the way he said my name, the way he looked at me. I had to talk to him. We had to talk. About this. Right now. Even back then, I could sense how pivotal this moment was, how our entire futures somehow hung in the balance of this conversation. I'd gone out to the dirt circle to find Daniel, but nobody was there. I thought maybe they'd all been escorted out, or someone had called security on us. I walked past the stables and didn't see him anywhere in the parking lot either. I turned to go back in, back to Tyler, when I heard Corinne's soft words somewhere out of sight. I passed the stables to my right, her voice, her laughter, drawing me in. I saw Corinne first, behind the building just outside the fair, holding a wet paper towel to my brother's face, her head on his shoulder, her other hand under his shirt, at his waistband, trailing over his skin. I watched her gently press her lips to his jaw and whisper something in his ear, and from her posture, from the way my brother was relaxed against the wall, I knew this wasn't the first time. I knew he saw me because he moved his hands quickly and ineffectively, pushing her off before I spun away, and I heard her words cut into him in displeasure as he pushed her back, but it was too late. He lied, and he knows I know it. He knows I lied for him, too. "Never," I said. "Never." I wondered if Annalise saw that, if she was in the trees somewhere, or crouched between the cars in the parking lot. She was too young to get home on her own. She would have needed an adult. She must have been nearby. I wondered what it looked like to her at the age of 13. What did she think was happening from the distance, from her hiding spot? And if she revisited it as an adult, did the memory shift on her, grow into a different understanding? I had thought I was the only one who knew about Corinne and Daniel, but maybe I wasn't. I never knew exactly what happened between the two of them, or with Bailey after that. I ran back inside, was beside the shed before Tyler came out. We left in his truck, and he let me drive because of his hand, and we passed a bunch of kids from school who teased Tyler.
"Damn, letting your girl drive your truck?"
A girl added, Now that's true love. I didn't know how Daniel and Corinne got separated, when or how Corinne met up with Jackson, or why Daniel was driving Bailey home. I didn't dare ask. None of us asked. I people-watched from the entrance for a long time, trying to imagine how these moments might look through the lens of a camera. What would I see if this moment were frozen? What would I think? Of the mother grabbing the child's arm, one step from disappearing into the crowd. Of the teenagers in line for the tilt-a-whirl, kissing while the others looked away. Of the woman with long black hair, holding the hand of a little girl, frozen in the middle of the crowd, watching me back. Her face sharpened in my mind, gaining context, and I was jarred into action, walking toward her. "Bailey?" I called. Bailey. Her face turning away, black hair cascading in an arc as she spun around. It wasn't in church, but in moments like this when I maybe believed in God or something like that, some order to the chaos, some meaning, that we collide with the people we need, that we meet the ones who will love us, that there's some underlying reason to everything. Bailey standing in the middle of the fair on the one night I was there. Bailey, whom I hadn't seen since I graduated from college. Bailey, who had been here with us the night we all fell apart. My whole body tingled with the feeling that I was meant to be here, that the universe was laying out the pieces for me, that time was showing something to me. I knew she'd seen me, had frozen just as I had, but she was moving away through the crowd. I was halfway to her now, pushing through the kids running for the next ride. "Bailey!" I called again. She stopped when I'd nearly reached her, looked over her shoulder, made herself look surprised to see me. "Nick, wow, long time," she said. We stared at each other, neither speaking, the little girl still holding her hand. "You have a daughter?" I asked, smiling at the girl. She clung to Bailey's leg, half her face hidden, one hazel eye staring up at me.
"Where's Daddy?"
she asked, her face tilted up to her mother. "I don't know," Bailey said, scanning the crowd. "He should be here." "I didn't know you got married," I said. "Well, you missed it. Divorced now. Getting one, anyway." She scanned the crowd again, I assumed for her ex. "What about you?" she asked, still searching. "Married? Kids?" "No and no," I said, though I didn't think she was listening. "There," she mumbled as she raised her hand over her head.
"Peter!"
Peter was clean-cut, clean-shaven, square-jawed, and taller than average, and I disliked him on sight. Maybe from the way he walked, like he knew he was something worth looking at. Maybe from the way he grinned at Bailey as their daughter ran to him, like he was keeping score of something and she was losing. "You're late," she said. She thrust an overnight bag at him. "She has swimming lessons at 10.
"I know,"
he said. Then he looked at me and smiled.
"Hi, I'm Peter."
I raised an eyebrow at him until his smile faltered.
"Okay. Well, come on, sunshine. Let's leave Mommy to her fun."
Bailey squatted close to the ground, grabbed the girl, held her tight. "See you tomorrow, love," she said. She stood slowly and watched them move deeper into the fair. "Well, it was good seeing you, Nick. I've got to get going. I need to ask you something. About Corinne." Her eyes widened. Then she turned and walked toward the exit. "Bailey!" I caught up with her at the side of the tilt-a-whirl, the cars coming dangerously close to the edge of the track before being yanked back. "No, Nick. I'm done with that. We're all done with that." I squeezed my eyes shut. "Bailey, just answer the fucking question and I'll be gone." I was talking to her like Corinne would have talked to her, the words out before I could stop them. And she was waiting, like she always did. I almost didn't want to press her, but I had to know. "Annalise Carter. Do you remember her?" She crossed her arms over her chest. "I hear she's missing. Did she ever try to talk to you? About Corinne? About that night?" She started to shake her head, then stopped. Her eyes shone. "What?" I asked. "It was weird," she said. I mean, I barely knew her then, and I don't live there anymore. But a few months ago, I ran into her at the farmer's market in Glenshire. Bailey always ended sentences like that, like she was excusing us for something we might not know. I nodded, waiting for her to go on. Or I guess she ran into me. I didn't really recognize her, but she said Bailey? Bailey Stewart? Like we'd been friends. Really, I think it was the first time she ever spoke to me.
What did she want? I asked. Did she ask about Corinne?
No, not at all, she said. She scrunched up her face. She asked me to lunch, asked if I ever needed a babysitter for Lena. It was like she wanted to be my friend.
Did you do it? Go out to lunch? Ask her to babysit?
No, I'm too old for friends like that, for people from home. She stared into my eyes. I grew up, Nick. I'm not the same girl.
Do you remember?
She put up her hand. You said one question. You said you'd be gone. Her voice trailed off and she lost her confidence, her mouth slightly ajar, her eyes following something just past my shoulder. I caught sight of the back of a man walking alone, cigarette in hand, hair falling in a mop over his face. Something so familiar about the way he walked with his shoulders hunched forward. Is that Jackson? I asked.
Hmm?
She was jarred back to the conversation. Oh, I don't know. Haven't seen him in ages.
Last I heard, he was working at Kelly's, I said.
She shrugged. I don't go there anymore.
He didn't do it, Bailey, I said.
Bailey took a step away so her back was up against the side of a hot dog stand. I know that, she said, which surprised me. It was her words that had landed the suspicion on him. Her answers to Hannah Pardoe. Her accusations. Then why did you make everyone think he did?
They told me she was pregnant. Jackson lied about it, and then the cops came in demanding answers. I was just a kid, she yelled.
No, you were 18. We were all 18. Everything you said became evidence. Everything. You ruined him.
Everyone had a motive, Nick. If it wasn't him, who do you think it would have been? Bailey was smarter than I gave her credit for being back then, but she was just as capable of deceit as I remembered.
Really? What was your motive, Bailey?
God, you're terrible. But I thought I knew. The man walking behind us, Jackson Porter. What does the monster make you do? Does it make you dream of them? Of boys who aren't yours?
It wasn't me. She was the monster. Can't you see that now?
We're all better off without her, Bailey said.
Don't say that.
Truth is, I believed Bailey was lucky. For Bailey Stewart, life with Corinne could have gone two very different ways. Bailey was gorgeous, naturally alluring, but Cooley Ridge was Corinne's. The attention was always hers. Bailey could either submit to Corinne, let her push her around, or Corinne could destroy her. Bailey was lucky she was weak, that she bent and folded so easily. There were worse things than being a doormat. But Bailey also had a darkness in her that let her be manipulated, that wanted out. She was lucky to be loved by Corinne. Truth or dare, Bailey? Corinne moved the soda straw from side to side in her mouth. Dare, I thought. Take the dare.
Truth,
Bailey said. Corinne's smile stretched wide. Jackson or Tyler, and explain. There was no right answer. There never was.
I changed my mind, Bailey said. Dare.
No, 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 Bailey, my dear. Truth or you can leave. Now tell me, which of our boyfriends would you like to make yours?
I'd leaned back on my elbows, watching Bailey shift in discomfort. Corinne caught my eye and grinned.
Always take the dare, Bales, I said.
Tyler, Bailey said,
her high cheekbones tinged red.
I laughed. Liar.
She set her eyes on me.
You get a free pass everywhere, Nick. People think you're better than you are because of him. That's my reason. Tyler.
Corinne laughed. Well played, Bailey.
She pulled Bailey toward her, wrapped her arms around her from the side, and squeezed.
God, I love you to death. The both of you. You're horrible.
I hated that Bailey acted so beyond it now, that she would call Corinne a monster as if she could strip out the rest. Tell yourself whatever you want, Bailey. You always were an excellent liar. Don't act like you don't know what I'm talking about. I heard her, Bailey said. I heard what she said at the top of the Ferris wheel. I shook my head, pretending not to remember. Who says something like that? She asked. She was sick, Nick, and she was contagious. I don't know what you're talking about, I said. She laughed like the joke was on me now. I gotta go. Wait, I said. Can I call you later? We can meet up someplace. Without all this? Meaning the fair. Meaning the Ferris wheel looming above us as we talked, turning us harsh and defensive. No, she said. Let it go. Bailey knew something more. I was sure of it. I wished Everett were here to push her, convince her to lay bare her secrets, to absolve herself. I grabbed a napkin from the nearest booth, found a pen in my purse, and scribbled my number on it. If you change your mind, I'm in town for a while, helping out with my dad. She slid the napkin into her back pocket. God, she was beautiful. Every movement of her body looked choreographed. Goodbye, Nick. Your daughter is beautiful, I said. She started leaving, tossed her hair over her shoulder, gave me one last searing look. I hope she isn't like us. I heard the ride beside us, the gears shifting, metal on metal as the cars came to an abrupt stop and began spinning the opposite way, the squeals of delight from inside. I tried to focus on that, on every individual sound, so I wouldn't think about me and Bailey and Corinne at the top of the Ferris wheel. I must have seemed so pathetic to Bailey, standing here, pretending not to know what she was talking about when that whispered word had become louder and louder over the years, so that sometimes when I thought of Corinne, it was the only thing I heard. Her cold hands at my elbows, her breath in my ear, Bailey's laughter tight and nervous in the background, the scent of Corinne's spearmint gum, her fingers dancing across my skin. Jump, she said. She told me to jump. The day before. Day 6. I had a few hours before I needed to be at Laura's baby shower in the church basement, but every time I thought of that room, I pictured Officer Fraze organizing us into search parties, and I saw the pictures of Annalise and Corinne hanging from the walls, interchangeable in my mind now.
So you'll be there at noon?
Daniel was outside the house with a pressure washer, two steps up a ladder, leaning against the siding. I said I would.
Give me the list,
he said, hand extended. Seriously? You're just going to work on the house now? Get it ready to sell? He jerked his hand forward a second time.
Come on. I'm not allowed to be there anyway.
I reached up to hand him the paper, and he skimmed the page.
Pressure washer. Got it. Okay, I'll do the grouting after, and the painting if Tyler comes to help.
Tyler's coming?
I don't know. He was going to, but I haven't heard from him.
He said, cutting his eyes to me.
So do me a favor and pull all the furniture you can away from the walls. I'll handle the bigger pieces. Go get the plastic sheets out of the trunk.
He went back to spraying the house. We were really doing this. Selling the house. Getting it ready. Going about our lives. Moving on.
Nick,
he said.
Trunk. Go.
I felt ungrounded as I walked to his car, as if in a daze. Sleep had been hard to come by the last few nights, and it was doing something to my head, like there was too much space to sort through and I couldn't get a grip on any one solid thing. I pulled the sheets of plastic from the trunk, the smell slightly nauseating, held them against my chest so they billowed up in front of my face. I imagined suffocating inside them, draping them across crime scenes. My mother used to lay plastic sheets across the floor so Daniel and I could paint on easels in the kitchen, and after, they'd be covered in spills and drips, speckles of color, a beautiful accident. I couldn't breathe. I dropped them at the bottom of the porch steps, and Daniel turned to look at me.
Nick, really?
He said, like I was the colossal disappointment of his life. I don't feel good. He turned off the machine, walked down the ladder.
"Well, if you're not going to help here,"
he said,
"then get to the church and help there."
I nodded. "I'll probably be back late. I have plans after."
"You have plans after?"
"Yes," I said. "I have plans. Plans that consisted of wanting to be anywhere but here."
"You can stay with me and Laura tonight. The paint fumes. I wouldn't want to breathe them in either."
"Maybe," I said. He nodded.
"Good. See you later, then."
Maybe it was the church's proximity to the police station, or maybe it was the graveyard behind it, where my mother was buried beside my grandparents. But there was something unsettling about this place, with the wooden pews smelling like earth, and the way you had to walk down the narrow aisle and over the altar to get to the basement steps beyond. I'd spent every Sunday here as a kid, but I'd stopped attending after my mom died, as did Daniel. My dad wasn't usually there either, too busy sleeping off the Saturday binge, or just sleeping. And Tyler went only if I asked him to go with me. There was nothing for me under this steepled roof anymore. Church was just another part of my life here. The thing you did on Sunday mornings, followed by snacks from CVS with Corinne and Bailey and whoever else was hanging out with us at the time. We'd sit on the top of car hoods in the summer, or huddle inside the store when the weather turned, Luke Aberdeen usually behind the cash register, keeping an extra close eye on us for good reason. The last time I'd been to church here was for Daniel and Laura's wedding 3 years ago. I had that unsettled feeling back then, too. Standing up beside the altar in a watermelon pink dress Laura had picked out and guessed my measurements on, because I'd never sent them to her. It was a little too long, hitting at shin level instead of just below the knee, too tight across the top and gaped at the armholes. I felt out of place. I looked out of place. I'd sneaked into this basement after, waiting out the crowd. Tyler had found me playing darts by myself in the rec room. I'd heard his footsteps rounding the corner, heard him toss his blazer on the nearest chair, while I took aim at the target with one eye closed.
"Nice dress,"
he'd said. "Shut up."
"Want to get out of here?"
He showed me a secret way out, a set of steps through a closet in the back, a storm shutter, a chain with a master lock holding it closed. But Tyler had the code from when he worked down here after a flood. He had a way out of everything. Daniel did not forgive me for missing the reception.
"Nick!"
Laura squealed when she saw me, waddling away from her older sister and mother who were hanging decorations. I smiled. "Daniel said you could use some help here."
"Oh my God, yes," she said. She leaned in closer. "My mother is crazy. Katie's trying to keep her occupied, but she's gone off the deep end. I can't tell whether she's excited or terrified of becoming a grandmother."
I nodded too quickly. There were tiny moments, like this, when the grief came on strong out of nowhere. It was sneaky and tricky. You couldn't see it coming until it was already there. It came with the mundane, simple tasks. My mother would never be hanging pink streamers at my shower. I would never lean over to someone and conspiratorially whisper, "My mother is crazy." She would never become a grandmother. Laura sucked in a quick breath, rubbing her stomach as if working out a kink.
"Let me get you some punch."
"No, thanks. Just put me to work."
"Okay. Katie?"
she called over her shoulder.
"What can Nick do?"
I let Katie sweep me up in the details, hanging a sign, setting up the games, placing the cupcakes just so on the folding tables. Her eyes kept drifting to the board the cops had used in the corner. Annalise's picture was still pinned to the wall, along with a white grid sheet sectioning off the woods, each box with an assigned letter. Bricks and Officer Fraze had met us all here and organized us into groups. I had been on Team C, which searched the Carter property, stretching to the river. Daniel got A, which was Piper, including the abandoned house. Nothing there, he'd told us after. McElroy and us. Tyler was in E, which was nowhere near the Carter place. He had the neighborhoods and property behind the elementary school, and don't think we didn't notice. I took it upon myself to pull everything off the wall, storing it all face down under the table.
"Thank you," Katie said. I felt bad taking them down, but who wants to look at that during a baby shower? She shook her head. She had hair like her sister's, long and fine, but hers was loaded with material that made it poof up near the top. Katie was twice divorced already, but I saw a ring on her finger. "Congratulations," I said. "Third time's the charm," she said in a sing-songy voice. "What about you? I hear you're engaged to some hot-shot lawyer up north." I felt the burn of her gaze on my empty finger. "Yes, the ring's getting cleaned, though. If you ever need wedding advice, you know who to ask." She laughed to herself. "Thanks, Katie." An hour later, the place looked like a tribute to cotton candy as the guests began to arrive.
"Oh," Katie said, "the present table."
She thrust a few wrapped boxes on top of the table in the corner with pink and green wrapped mints scattered around. "I left my present in the rec room," I said. The rec room was through the kitchen, attached to the bathrooms, and I heard the toilet flush just as I grabbed my gift bag. I closed my eyes and reached inside to feel it one last time. I'd gone to Babies R Us with the intention of finding the perfect gift, but I'd been completely overwhelmed by the enormity of the place. Aisles upon aisles, an entire industry devoted to the production and growth of tiny humans, and I had absolutely no idea where to start. And I didn't know what Daniel and Laura wanted or needed. I checked the kiosk near the door for their registry, but they didn't seem to have one, so I bought a tiny outfit, a tiny pink gingham dress with a tiny pink hat and tiny pink socks. Later, I asked one of the teachers at work what her favorite baby gift had been. "A breast pump," she'd said. "Oh, and don't get clothes." That night, as I was boxing up my things for storage, I opened the one bin I'd taken from home. My mother's things, just sitting there, boxed away. Things I'd rifle through and never use. Things I took with me after all. I'd left them inside a gray plastic bin the whole time, too scared that I'd ruin them, or that someone would break into my crappy apartment and take them. And now I realized I'd forgotten a card. Son of a bitch. Laura came out of the restroom, head tilted to the side, her hair falling over both shoulders.
"For me?"
she asked. "I forgot a card," I said.
"Oh, that's okay."
She went to take the bag from me, but I couldn't do it. Couldn't lose it in the sea of gifts on the table. She moved her hands to my arms.
"Can I open it now?"
I nodded, and she smiled. I held the bag while she moved the tissue paper aside, first pulling out the tiny pink outfit, her smile stretching wide. Then she reached deeper, her face twisting as she felt the cold metal, maybe her fingers brushing over the engraving. She pulled out the silver jewelry box with my mother's name engraved on top. It had been a gift from my father on their wedding day. "Shayna Farrell," it said, in this perfect script. Fancy, but easy to read. Formal, but not pretentious. Laura didn't say anything. A tear rolled down her cheek as she watched the light catch the name on the surface.
"Oh, Nick," she said, her hand up to her mouth and then down to her belly.
"Oh, don't do that. Oh, God, don't have the baby now. I'm not equipped." She smiled, shaking her head.
"I can't take this. It's yours."
"I'll never have a Shayna Farrell," I said. "Please. She would have given it to you if she were here. I know it." It was true. I could picture her doing this. Feel her standing in this very spot, reaching for Laura, smoothing her hair. She shook her head again but kept the box in her hands.
"Thank you," she said.
"Laura?" Katie poked her head back in.
"The guests are here, babe. You okay?"
Laura wiped her cheeks, held my hand, and squeezed.
"We will take good care of this, Nick," she said. "Are you coming?"
"In a minute. Go ahead," I said. I spent a few moments in the bathroom, which had always been my favorite place for a good cry. The shower was in full-on party mode. Laura's friends holding punch, grouped together with cupcakes and miniature sandwiches. Her mom and sister restocking the trays and moving effortlessly from group to group. People placing bets on the birth date on a sheet of paper hung over the gift table. I leaned against the entrance, readying myself for the show.
smile, be friendly, for Laura. I don't think they're related, I heard one of her friends say as she pulled the papers out from underneath the table. She was in Laura's high school class. I knew her, knew of her at least. Same shade of hair, dyed a deep red. Monica Duncan. At least, that had been her maiden name. Annalise was nothing like Corinne Prescott. They hovered around the search party grid and Annalise's picture, which I'd taken down and hidden to specifically avoid nosy hands, prying words, everything I hated about this place. Laura stood on the other side of them, her back to us, but she looked over her shoulder and said, "Oh, hush now, Monica." They waited for Laura to turn back around, and Monica lowered her voice. "What?" she said. "It's true. Don't you remember? That girl used to come around to our parties when she was barely 14. 14, the bunch of them. Remember?" Laura looked over her shoulder again, and I saw her face turning red, her eyes scanning the room. I shrank back into the kitchen. Hitting on our boyfriends? Acting like they owned the town. I mean, what did they think was going to happen? If that was them at 14, imagine them at 18. Wait, we don't even have to imagine. There were more than enough rumors. I couldn't believe they were talking like this at Laura's baby shower. Laura, who was married to Daniel, an unofficial suspect in that case. Laura, sister-in-law to Corinne's best friend. Annalise was such a sweet thing, never made a stir, knew her place. The Prescott girl? She was different. She was a disaster waiting to happen. Who here is really surprised? "I don't know," someone else said. Annalise was supposedly seeing Tyler Ellison. I heard nervous laughter. So maybe not so sweet after all. They all laughed. "Martin said the police showed up at Tyler's place this morning, for questioning, but he wasn't there," a third woman in the group added. God, the rumors, the conspiracy theories. This is how it starts. This is how people decide on innocence and guilt. Time for me to get out there. Make them stop because of my presence, and because they have nice southern manners, after all. "Can we please not talk about this at my shower?" Laura asked. "Oh, I don't want to upset you, dear," Monica said, a hand around Laura's waist. "What I'm saying is there's nothing for us to worry about. It's not the same thing. No pattern, no reason to think this is all connected," she whispered. I guess they hadn't heard about the text that Annalise had sent to Officer Mark Stewart asking about Corinne's case. It wouldn't be long, though. I rounded the corner, heading for the punch. Monica added, "Corinne, she got what she deserved. Put them all in their place, didn't it?" Laura had gone pale and was looking directly at me. "Monica," she said. "What?" Monica said. Laura pushed away from her toward me, but I backed out of the room again. "Oh, oops," I heard Monica say. There was no way to get through this shower without making a scene, by embarrassing either Laura or her friends. Laura still looked pale as she followed me into the kitchen. "I'm so sorry," I said, searching for my purse. "I have to go."
"Nick, don't. Please."
I found the strap to my black bag, swung it over my shoulder. "Congratulations, Laura," I said. They were right. This wasn't my place. I knew my place, and it wasn't here. Wasn't in Cooley Ridge. Laura couldn't keep up. I disappeared inside that storage room closet, walked up the back steps, and remembered the combination from 3 years earlier. 10-10-10. "People really are too trusting," Tyler had said. Pushed through the unlocked storm cellar door, and was gone. Corinne wasn't at fault, but she wasn't innocent. That's what Monica and everyone else implied. Corinne incited passion and rage, lust and anger. Someone couldn't help himself, but she brought it on herself, obviously. That's what you say to convince yourself, "It will never be me." She didn't know her place. She incited too much passion. It's typically men who commit murder in the heat of passion, their fingers tightening of their own accord around our slender necks. Their practiced arms swinging forward in an arc, beyond their own intention, into our fragile cheekbones. Passion, heat, instinct. Women are more deliberate, adding to silent lists of slights, tallying the offenses, building a case, retreating inward.